Welcome to Beyond the Lens, presented by Diesel Films. I am Seth Shapiro.
And I'm AJ Speaks.
After a chance meeting with super producer Seth Gordon on his first film set as a production assistant, Clay Tweel quickly packed his bags and moved from Virginia to Los Angeles. In LA, Tweel honed his craft as a jack of all trades. He learned to shoot and edit, and Gordon quickly put him to work on what is now a cult classic, The King of Kong. Tweel took that experience, what he considers his master's degree in documentary filmmaking, and became a director himself. In 2014, a sizzle about Steve Gleason's fight against ALS was being passed around Hollywood in search of a director, and Tweel knew he was the man for the job.
Clay Tweel is an enjoyable conversationalist. His ability to draw parallels between his subject and everyday humans is his gift as a filmmaker. I love how a game of ping pong helped seal his fate as the director of the heart-wrenching film Gleason, and how his father's famous client became an inspiration for the story. Gleason has so many layers to it, and we were lucky to have Clay join us to peel some back on this episode of Beyond the Lens, presented by Diesel Films.
On today's show, we welcome a man who is not afraid to tackle tough subject matter. He will make you laugh, and you better bring your box of tissues because he will make you cry. Director Clay Tweel. Clay, welcome to Beyond the Lens.
What's up, guys? Thanks for having me.
Kleenex owes you some money, man, because your film's in deep.
I mean, you know, I try to tap into some things. Some more successful than others, you know.
So, Clay, we like to break the podcast into three acts, with the first act being your story. Where did you grow up, and where did your love of storytelling come from?
I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia, and grew up in a household playing a lot of sports. My dad was a big sports nut, watched a lot of sports my whole life, and played everything when I was a kid, you know, basketball, baseball, soccer. Never played football. I was always a little too small. I didn't even meet the weight requirement that you had, like the minimum. Got into college, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I was pretty good at history. So I became a history major. And then in between my junior and senior year, I worked as an intern at a production company in Parkersburg, Virginia. I went to University of Richmond. And so I was 30 minutes down the road in Parkersburg at Tim Reed's studio called New Millennium Studios. And I was an intern there, and I just like got the bug of like being around films being made. Like this guy that I worked for, who I was interning for, was really good about just like, hey, try this, like learn, you know, I was doing graphic design work for him. And I was just like being around, seeing people editing, hearing these conversations. And it really made me look back and think like, oh yeah, growing up in Charlottesville, I didn't have a lot. When I wasn't playing sports, me and my friends were watching movies or even like sometimes making little short films or fake commercials or whatever ourselves. And I just realized that I had been steeped in like that culture my whole life and didn't even realize it. And it was a bit of an epiphany for me of feeling a little lost in college about what I wanted to do. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh yeah, like I want to make movies. This is like, it just clicked. And I was like, this is what I'm going to spend the rest of my life doing. I kind of knew it right then and there. And so I took all the film classes that University of Richmond offered, which was just like two or three, graduated, and a film was being set there by this director, Jeff Wadlow, that my older sisters knew. And so I got a job as, again, like an intern on his set, and met a bunch of people working on that movie, and then moved out to LA right after that. That was like my trajectory to get out to Los Angeles.
A lot of layers of that. I'm from Roanoke, Virginia, and I went to Fork Union. So I'm familiar with Charlottesville and how we grew up in that area. Then you had the NFL with the Washington football team and all of that. I'm curious, who was the person or the people that helped you in the filmmaking business? Who helped get you to that next layer, that next step where you ended up in LA?
There wasn't really a lot of people fostering that besides like my friends who I said we would, you know, make movies together, little short films or whatever. Once I worked on that film set, the movie's called Cry Wolf. And I met a lot of people, and I met, you know, beyond Jeff, there was another guy I met named Seth Gordon. When I moved out to LA, I had lunch with him, and he was like, well, what do you want to do? Like, tell me what is it? And he took me under his wing, and he just said, here, learn some of these programs and I can help get you work. And then you can sort of like figure it out. And so he gave me Final Cut Pro. He gave me After Effects. He at the time also ran a graphics company. So it was just like, learn these things and I'll get you work. And that really set me off because I had never done a lot of editing myself. And that was this new skill that I really took to. So for me, Seth was sort of that person that had a lot of patience, fostered my creativity, gave me some of the tools and advice to start working in the industry. And part of that mentality was, just try to learn as many things as you can, you know, like learn how to shoot, learn, go out in the field and, you know, or borrow a friend's camera and not only watch movies, but go out and try to execute some of this stuff yourself. I took that jack of all trades approach. I mean, coincidentally, so Seth, I don't know if you guys know this movie, but
King of Kong.
King of Kong. Yeah. So that was the first documentary I worked on. And he just probably 6 months after me moving out to LA, he was like, hey, I have this footage of these 40-year-old guys playing Donkey Kong. Do you want to look at it and like help me log it just so I know what's in it? Like, I haven't even looked back at the footage. I started doing assistant editing work on that. And that led to a trajectory of 3 years worth of work for me working on that with him, which was kind of what I consider to be my film school, just putting that whole movie together with him from beginning to end.
The King of Kong, which is a cult classic in the documentary world. What was special about working on that film and that experience? I watch it and I still don't quite know what I'm looking at, but you know, through the years, that's always been a documentary that gets referenced as one of the best.
For me, it showed the way in which an audience will connect to characters if they care about something. Meaning, like, you know, you wouldn't think that a story about people playing arcade video games, especially retro games, would be that interesting. But the characters, the people themselves, the people that we were filming, cared about it so much that it made the audience care. It was mind blowing for me to see that, because I didn't, you know, here we are, there's like three or four of us making this movie. We would do test screenings and people just loved it and would freak out about it and would be like quoting the movie back to us almost instantly. And we're like, what? How? I mean, this is cool. Maybe some people will see this, but you never know. And then when it came out, it just took off. So the, like, telling a good character story and getting people invested in the motivations behind sort of like why people do what they do, even on in a story that on its face sounds sort of silly, was really a big lesson for me and something that I've carried through all the rest of my work.
Seems like that lesson and then also the one of being a jack of all trades, because correct me if I'm wrong, on that film, you did a little bit of everything. Can you walk us through that process and what you learned from it?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I say I consider it sort of my film school, because I did assistant editing work. I did the graphics. I onlined the movie. I did a little bit of camera work out in the field. I made a song in GarageBand that actually like made it on into the movie and onto the soundtrack, which is hilarious because I still get like a check for like $12 every year from like the, you know, the Australian streaming rights of King of Kong. But it just gave me like a little taste of everything, of like, you know, every part of the process. I mean, I have the Donkey Kong machine in my office here that we had in the office back then. So I'd say like 30 to 40% of the insert shots in that movie of gameplay are me playing just with the camera over my shoulder. I got really good at Donkey Kong. One of the things I love about documentary films in general, which is also a lesson learned from King of Kong, was you just become an expert in these tiny focused fields or subcultures. I like that a lot, you know, like learning a lot about retro games or Donkey Kong or the strategies around it, or learning about, I did another documentary on 3D printing. You know, it's just like finding these little cultures to investigate and understand is very cool for me.
After you took that experience from King of Kong, what was your big break into directing with documentaries?
So after King of Kong, I didn't know exactly what to do. I did a little bit of editing and graphics work. And then Seth was like, you had a lot of great ideas on Kong. You should think about trying to direct something. And his roommate at the time, this guy, Stephen Klein, had this idea to do a documentary on teenage magicians. They sort of came together and they asked me if I wanted to direct it. And I jumped at the chance. And so I was like, yeah, this sounds awesome. We have living in LA here, we have the Magic Castle, which has its own youth group. So there was an immediate sort of pool of people to try to go and film and see if we could find some good characters. People didn't really know how to classify the King of Kong when it came out. I remember when we were playing at Tribeca, I think ESPN presented it as a sports movie. And then, you know, we were at the Aspen Comedy Festival as a comedy. So it was just sort of like this genre bending thing. The movie that I started to direct about magicians, I found a similar thing of like, well, it's still a kind of a competition movie. And there's one kid called it like magic is just like an athlete of small movements. And I was like, okay, I'll approach it like that. And so we sort of took that same approach of piggybacking off of the structure of Spellbound, which is a great documentary about the spelling bee competition, and just tried to find some good characters and went into the Magic Castle here in LA, found this competition in Las Vegas where people, kids from all over the world come. And then that's when it really locked into place of like, oh, we have one competition where everyone's coming to, and we can just center it around that. Yeah, it was a cool, really cool experience for me. And I think that one of the big things I learned from that movie was I was kind of going through the same thing that these kids in the magic competition were. So I was directing my first movie. I was still trying to get my footing and find my voice of like who I am, what I want to say, how I want to say it. And these teenagers were doing the same thing with their magic acts. And there were all these kids were very mature for their age, very grown up and thinking about these things and talking about them. And I was like, man, when I was 17, there was no way I didn't have the maturity level or the sort of emotional intelligence to do that. And these kids were doing it. I found that inspiring and really cool. And I was sort of like almost in it with them in that way. Great experience for me. We got to premiere the movie at the LA Film Festival, and it ended up winning the grand jury prize there. And then Showtime bought it. So it was a great launching pad for my directing career.
Has that become a theme for you? Trying to find ways to connect yourself to the film and then just really involve yourself without involving yourself, if that makes any sense.
It's a double-edged sword for me, AJ, because I've heard many people say like, oh, every movie you do is just a reflection of who you are. I find that a little bit like egotistical. Like I'm truly trying to find the person who I'm covering story and like present it as truthfully as I can through my eyes, but also just like give them the agency to tell their own story. But it's like there's inherent bias in every edit point that you choose, every music cue, every part of putting a film together like has a point of view. And so you can't totally strip those away from each other. So it is in a lot of ways, all these movies are a reflection of my thoughts or who I am in some degree. But I try to be as conscious as I can to make it involve our sort of subjects' perspectives as much as possible.
I think that's a great segue into Act Two. And let's talk about Gleason, shortlisted for an Academy Award. Actually very surprised it wasn't nominated and didn't win. I don't know the other films that year in 2016.
It's a great year.
It must have been. In brief, a film about NFL special teams ace Steve Gleason in his battle versus ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and that is totally underselling it. You better have your Kleenex ready if you're going to watch it. Let's dip into Gleason. A lot to unpack there. How did you get involved with Gleason?
Coming off of Make Believe, it did. Okay. And so I ended up getting like a manager and an agent out of it. The way I first heard about Gleason, honestly, was like a sizzle trailer being sent around town that was trying to find a director for this project. And it had been sent to all the agencies and my agent sent it to me. And I watched, it was like a 7-minute piece. It honestly just floored me. I remember watching Steve block the punt back in 2004 or five after Katrina, and just like I watched that in real time on Monday Night Football, and I remember being very emotional even then and not even really having a connection to New Orleans or any, it just, you know, it was like an amazing moment. So I watched this sizzle and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I remember turning to my wife and I was just like, I have to tell this story. I'm called my agent back after like 10 minutes after he sent it to me, and I was like, well, what do I have to do to direct this? This is what's like, give me the story. What had happened was that the family had compiled a lot of footage over the years, is what I was told. And they were just like, yeah, there's a treasure trove of stuff. You should talk to them. And I was like, well, I want to talk to them in person. So I called the producers. And at the time, I just had this mentality of like, go big or go home. And so I asked them if I could fly down and go to Steve and Michelle's house and meet with them, tell them in person why I felt this story was something I had to do and was so impactful and why I cared about it. Part of that pitch to them was, growing up, my dad was Muhammad Ali's lawyer for 30 some odd years. And so, you know, seeing Muhammad and seeing his wife, Lonnie, they're personal heroes of mine, both of them, their dynamic and how they navigated like the attention and success and having to go through disease in a very public way just has been a part of my life. And I was always thinking like, well, how can I tell that story? And there's also a bazillion things done on Muhammad every year. And this sort of afforded me an opportunity to do that, but through a proxy. I told them I'd been thinking about that story for years and years. And I was just interested in that dynamic of what does it really take to get through a disease? And what does it mean to be a public person and have to deal with that? So I flew down there and talked to them about it.
What year is this?
2014. Steve was diagnosed in 2011. Talked to them about it. Steve has just lost his voice. And so he's using the eye gaze technology to write things on his screen and talk. His setup is amazing. So he's got like TV screens in his house hooked up like wirelessly, able to be controlled by his tablet on through his eyes. And so he just types out, hey, dude, check this out. Check out some footage. And he pulls up some raw footage from his like home server and plays it on the TV. And it is the raw footage of this faith healer that he and his dad go to see, which is a pretty wild scene in the movie. That's the first footage that I saw that just like Steve pulled up. And I was like, holy cow, this is intense. There, that scene has so many layers of fathers and son dynamics and religion and sports and masculinity. There's a lot of stuff. I just was even more blown away. I was like, oh my God, Steve. Okay. Well, this is the first thing you're showing me out of the gate. I can't wait to see what else is there. Oh, one other little story was like, I saw they had a ping pong table and I was like, who plays ping pong? She was like, I do. Michelle, his wife, she challenged me to a game. She's really good. And I ended up beating her and she was like by 1 point or something. And she was like, okay, I think I like you. So I got the job that day. And then they told me they had 1200 hours of footage that they'd captured over 3 years. There were a couple guys, Timon and Small and David Lee, who had basically caretakers, but also filmmakers. They were these young film students and they came on as filmmakers early on and then sort of became caretakers and then became family members, really part of the inner circle there. And so they had helped along with just the rest of the family captured so much footage. So then it was my job to try to sort through it and find a cohesive story. I was having to figure out a way to get through that amount of footage, but also with the constraints of like, we need to put this movie together pretty quickly. Like, we don't know how long Steve's going to be around. He wants to do it quick. Welcome aboard and kind of like hurry the hell up. And so we had a very aggressive mission from the start. Try to get the movie into Sundance the next year.
We've all been there where you had to log and organize film, but 1300 hours is crazy. So yeah. What was your process? How did you go about organizing all of that film?
I really had to draw on all of my editorial experience. You know, through the years, I had sort of designed a methodology of organizing footage within the edit program. And it's kind of based on the way I think, like every editor has their own version of how they like to organize stuff. I work very much in chronological order. I work in sort of by date. We made a giant Google Doc spreadsheet of like every SD card of footage, figured out how many hours it was. Then I would bring it in and just like look at it with Ty and David, who had a, you know, they lived a lot of this. They would say, oh, I remember these sort of like key moments. And then we would go through and between me, Ty, David, and the co-editor, Brian Palmer, a friend of mine who worked on that and my previous movie, started cranking on watching footage every day, all day. I have a rough system of like, I feel like you can reasonably log about 3 to 4 hours of footage per day by like tagging it for content. It's very intensive, like focus, and it's very mentally draining. So we just sat down, all of us, and did that for about 5 months straight. And then by the end, we had this meeting. And I sat down and I said, okay, I want everybody to write down what your favorite like five things were that you saw. We all made that list. And then we were just like, okay, what would the film look like if we just took these 20 scenes and put them together? And that right there was essentially the backbone of the film that you saw. There was so much stuff. It was so much. I just wanted to know like what was the most visceral things in the footage. We structured it with having those things as the backbone, but then, you know, like this, the movie is very, it's a roller coaster. And what we've quickly found was like, we need to have some moments that like break the tension. And Steve and Michelle are hilarious. Mm-hmm. They're like, that's part of their magic is that they know how to like say what they're feeling when they're feeling it. And also they have this like incredible like joy for life mixed with some gallows humor. And it provided us with that ability to really show them trying to keep a light mood in some pretty dark situations. And so that became the emotional ride of like trying to have these intense moments with him, but also understand the lightheartedness of it. And my hope was anyway, guys, that the movie was going to be an intense journey. I knew that, but I hoped that by the end, it was going to be satisfying and inspiring in a way that's like, you either get busy living or you get busy dying, you know, like it's a sort of inspirational story in that way.
Absolutely. It was definitely a journey of ups and downs, and there was a lot going on there. I read that you use the hero's journey to sequence your films. I don't know too much about that concept. Can you explain that to us?
So the hero's journey is Joseph Campbell. It's based on a lot of like mythology throughout the human history. It's probably most famously known as a lot of the inspiration for Star Wars. There's many versions of like derivatives of that, and almost like in screenwriting books, you hear it out here a lot too. There's Sid Fields on writing or Blake Snyder, Save the Cat. It is a way to look at the tropes of a lot of storytelling throughout human history. You start with this a protagonist, and they have some sort of conflict early on. And then there's a call to action. You have like three or five act structures. And it's something that I studied sort of on my own, being out here in LA, story structure, to really get an understanding of that early in my career. There's also another great book called The Seven Basic Plots by Christopher Booker. For me, it gives you a baseline of like, okay, here's what people are sort of subconsciously expecting when they see a cinematic narrative experience. The job is then to make them not aware of that. Like, how do you do it and hide it in a way that people aren't expecting what's coming next? For me, that's really fun, is like finding ways to subvert the audience's expectations of things while also using some of the tropes that they're aware of. For Gleason, you had this really wild experience where you're going to see some guy go from peak physical health of being a, you know, an NFL athlete to an invalid. At the same time, you're going to have his son being born early in the movie as like an infant and then grow into, so he's going to be gaining his faculties while Steve is going to be losing them. And there's a point in the movie where at Rivers, his son's first birthday, they're sort of at the same point, you know, like they both need the same amount of help eating cake and getting around, and like a really poignant moment it was for me in just watching that footage. So that's sort of how we were structuring the film in conjunction with trying to have that hero's journey of Steve, like, you know, trying to figure out this internal struggle with like who he was and dealing with his past.
It really resonated just watching Michelle's face, because you had some really, really tight shots of her. And you could just see that she was having that struggle. And she said as much at one point. How was it working with her? How vulnerable was she? Because she felt like she was just honest as hell. And she's just an open person. And like,
yes,
you thought for a moment they were going to get divorced, and I just didn't know where this whole thing was going, but I felt like the whole time she was just straight up with you.
That's the type of person she is. She wears her heart on her sleeve. She just says what she's feeling, for better or worse. You know, she just puts it out there. I love her so much, and I think that she's kind of the secret weapon of the movie's success, because that role that she took on as a caretaker was not really profiled in a lot of pieces about Steve. And seeing that struggle and sort of the realness of the, you know, their marital fights there towards the end, and just like the stress and the toll that it took on her. For me, that was one of the more heartbreaking things of the movie, and watching all that footage in those 5 months was like seeing somebody who had such a joy and like this light in her eye, and then have that slowly fade over 3 years of watching footage because she was just so stressed out. You know, I think this is a stat that we didn't put in the movie, but we debated it for a while. It was like, I think 90% of all ALS patients get a divorce.
Dang.
With Michelle, I think she reached a point too where there's so much intimate footage and things that she was even doing to facilitate like filming what was happening over the years. There came a point when she just said, enough. Like, I'm not making this movie anymore, but I'm not shooting anymore. I don't want anybody filming me. This is too much.
Breaking point.
Yeah. By the time we were editing, I had like one last shot at filming with her. So I was like, all right, Michelle, you've done so much. Let me just get one like 2 hour sit down interview with you. Cause I kind of need some context to fill in the gaps of some things that were happening and some of this footage. She agreed to do that. And she did an amazing job. We sat down and did that interview, and it proved to be crucial to help tie some of these things together in the story. But I am in awe of her and everything she's had to go through.
Let me follow up on that interview real quick, because I felt like she had just watched some of that film when you were asking her. What was that? How did you do that? Did you ask her to watch it and then, or did she just recall it?
No, she just recalled it. I did not want to color any of what was going to be in the interview. You know, I don't like showing subjects the film until like the very last moment, because I think it really does oftentimes pervert what people will tell you on camera. They'll want to try to like control the narrative some way if they know what you're angling for. So you got to be careful. So she knows the story so well and lived it and was traumatized by it. So I didn't have to show her anything, but she still agreed to do the interview.
Clay, I wanted to ask you about the music. I'm a huge Pearl Jam fan. So
oh, yeah.
When I heard Just Breathe on the road trip to Alaska, my body just was covered in goosebumps, and it was just so emotional. Obviously, Steve had a relationship with Pearl Jam. Did you have carte blanche to their catalog? I feel like if you laid 10 underneath the whole film, it would have been, it would have worked, but it would have been a sob story. But what was your process of using their music and sort of scoring the film?
I learned early on that Steve had this connection with Pearl Jam and that he and Mike McCready had hit it off. It was presented to me like, if you want, you can use some of their music. And with Pearl Jam in particular, I was like, oh man, this is like essentially a biopic on Steve's life. And like, this is his favorite band and he's become friends with them. I want to do my due diligence and pay tribute to like who Steve is. And this is part of who he is. And so the band was really great. Even during the making of the editing of it, like Mike McCready offered to write some music and do a song that we used in the movie as well. So we had our composer, Dan Romer, but McCready came on and did a song, which was beautiful. And I did not show Steve and Michelle the cut until we had a complete rough cut. But as I was putting it together, he was definitely like sending me some some ideas. What about this song? And so I was like, all right, Steve, all right, you know, I'm working on it. The song when they were going on their trip to Alaska just like felt too perfect. And I wish I could have got more of their music in there, because like I said, it really is part of the soundtrack of Steve's life. And you hear it in the background of like a lot of the footage that we watched as well, because they just have it on all the time. To this day, even like Steve has a Gleason Graw in New Orleans every year. He just loves music. He like, you know, bands come and play. It's essentially a concert series. So he loves to be around music. It really brings light to his soul. So Pearl Jam allowed us to use a few songs, and then were even more incredible and really helped to promote the movie and push it out to their fans, and were able to use some of their songs and marketing materials. It's like, that's a big deal for a band of that size who's really got that reach, like, and for a documentary to be teaming up with them. It was an honor.
I wanted to follow up the Eddie Vedder interview that Steve did. Was a super powerful moment touching on the father-son relationship, which Eddie didn't grow up with his father. Did that happen after you came on board with the film, or was that interview already in the can when you came on board?
It had just been in the can when I came on board. That was actually filmed by ESPN. It was a segment that they did. So I didn't have a part of that. But as I dug into the movie and was structuring it, like I said, the father-son dynamics and sort of the, you know, Steve being worried about how he was going to be a good father for Rivers made him reflect on his relationship with his own father. I think that's a very common human thing. And I've heard it said many times, like, there's no better way to deal with the issues you have with your parents than to have your own children. Like, you get to see Steve dealing with that in real time. As I was digging through the footage and that father-son theme was just like so prevalent, that footage we got from ESPN just seemed to fit right in line with that. And it came at a point when you've already seen some scenes with Steve and his dad trying to hash out some of their issues. So it felt like it was like at a great moment there towards the back third of the film, where Steve could show you the perspective that he's gotten on it.
I've read where you said that your first idea is never the movie you make. What was your initial intention and how did you evolve that into the father-son relationship?
I was going to try to bring as much integrity and reality to what living with ALS was like and, you know, just show that the degenerative disease. I had no idea about the angle of caretaking and the effect it would have on spouses and Michelle's whole story. Like I said, I had no idea the extent to which there was going to be some existential sort of religious thoughts of like sort of life and death.
That was so interesting though. It came out of nowhere and it was just a powerful, like, sorry to cut you off, but they were just like going at it. And it's just like, whoa, I did not expect this. And it was so emotional. Like he wanted to punch him and he just didn't have the power to. And then it just turned into like, I'm sorry, that moment there for me was like, holy cow, I didn't see that coming.
Honestly, that was like the most powerful moment for me too in watching all the footage. The faith healer scene with his dad was just sort of the tee up for this moment that we're talking about where Steve is so angry. He's had basically a lifetime of frustration with his dad about religious beliefs and his dad sort of like dictating his way of thought onto his son. And he's had enough, you know, like Steve is being confronted with his own mortality here. And he's like, I have the agency to have my own thoughts. Like, please back off and respect my wishes. And so, yeah, it's so powerful that angle of religion and mortality and how to live when faced with death was like, I didn't really know. It's something I was interested in for sure. I had no idea we would get into that. Every film I've ever done shifts and changes. You come up with one idea and then it becomes another. But this even more so evolved in like had layers and layers and layers of stuff that I think elevated the movie in very powerful ways.
The way Steve opened up through his computer, the keyboard with his eyes was so human. It was unreal. I don't really have a question about that, but I just wanted to say that.
No, it was unreal.
It was unreal how he communicated through the computer, but it felt incredibly real.
When we were putting the movie together, I remember the first rough cut screening or two screenings that I had for a very small group of friends. At that point, there wasn't a lot of Michelle in the back half. And what it happens is as Steve loses his voice, we started to realize that, you know, and he's having to talk more and more through his computer. It's amazing that he can do that, but it almost had this effect on the audience that they were like losing a connection with him because it's like it's a robot voice. And so we had to try to find ways to keep them connected to him and keep him not like disassociate from him, you know, like keep him as human as possible. And so trying to find a way to use some of his video diaries when he could still talk early on later in the film, as well as that's when we segued into having Michelle's perspective slide in a little bit more and give the audience another person that they could connect to later in the film.
I noticed that because you brought her father in at that point and then he started helping narrate it as opposed to having to narrate it.
Yeah, but it was a wild experience as a filmmaker. It was a wild experience to think about of how much a person's voice really matters to like the emotional connection you have as an audience member.
Keeping that back and forth, I think, was important even when he was talking to the computer. Being entrusted to tell the story of Steve Gleason, being given 1,200 hours of footage that was uncanny, that brings a lot of pressure. How much of an emotional toll did this film take on you?
It took a lot. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I think the more I've had a chance to look back on it, the more I realize what it did do and how hard it was on me and on all of us putting the story together. But I have gout. You like can't process uric acid and it forms in these really hard crystals and it sort of settles in your feet. Mine is stress induced. And there was times towards the end of editing the movie right before Sundance when like I had such bad gout outbreaks that I couldn't walk. So I was like on crutches in the edit room trying to put the movie together. And I guess I just like didn't realize how much I was having to compartmentalize my emotions to put the film together the way it was. And so I very distinctly remember like, I think I cried like once very early on watching some footage and then did not ever do that again until we were at the sound mix 2 weeks before the Sundance premiere, and I'm watching the scene where Steve comes back into the stadium to lead the Hudette chant, and with Drew Brees out there on the 50-yard line with him, and just like the new score that we got had just come in, and we were putting it all together, and you know, you're sitting back and watching it on the big screen, and it just hit me, and I started crying, and I was like, oh man, like what? Oof. It was a little bit of a release for me. It was a very intense movie. And I took that pressure very seriously and wanted to do justice to everybody and to Steve and Michelle and all the Veriscos. Like, you know, I wanted them all to be proud of the film. To do that, I think I put a little bit of pressure on myself in that situation. With there was a lot of producers at the time. I was like, oh, I'm the conduit. I take everybody's opinion. I listen to them. I sort of put them through my own filter, and then I put it into the movie. In that way, it'll have a little piece of everybody's thoughts. I was the fulcrum to that, and I put a lot of pressure on myself to like make sure that everybody in our internal creative team was digging the movie and coming out the way they wanted it.
Did it impact your life at all during the making of the film, positively or negatively? And when were you able to breathe again once the film was finished?
Yeah, it did make me reflect on what kind of quality of life I wanted to have and what I stood for. Ultimately, it was a very positive experience in that way for me personally. The movie did very, very well. And, you know, we got bought at Sundance, and there was a long journey of that year of going out and promoting it where I wasn't really doing another film. I wasn't working on too much other stuff. And so I got to really just sort of like promote the movie. It was sort of became my job and celebrate it. And Amazon was great. They put a lot of resources behind it and they really wanted to push it. You know, I would say by like the springtime of 2016, when we put it out a couple months after Sundance, I was like, okay, I think this is like on the track. And I think it's going to do well. People seem to really like it. And the rest of that year, I felt very confident in the movie's ability to reach a wide audience.
Two questions I wanted to ask you. First, going back to the film a little bit about the footage. When you were in the bathroom and the nurse was in there, was there any footage that they told you you couldn't use?
Not really. I mean, they're an open book. I mean, have you seen the movie, like Steve's getting an enema on camera?
That's the part where I'm like, how did you, that was crazy. I'm like, I was curious if they let you show that. I was wondering if there's anything else. So maybe there wasn't.
It's been a few years. I mean, if you'd asked me this, you know, right after we put it together, maybe there was something, but I really don't remember anything major that they said I was off limits.
Yeah. So clearly nothing that you were upset about. So then, the other question I wanted to ask you was about Sundance, because that seemed like such a pivotal moment. When it's all done, walk us into that experience of showing it at Sundance, and then tell us how Amazon got involved.
First thing, we got into Sundance, which was like amazing, such an honor. And then it was like, okay, well, how do we get Steve there? If you've ever been to Park City up there during the wintertime, it's like small streets and it's not very handicap friendly. You know, that became the challenge of trying to get him and the whole team up there, because we really wanted, you know, this is his movie. This is like the movie in and of itself was his idea right when he got diagnosed. So he had to be there. We had to figure it out. I can't put into words what it was like still to this day of being able to have Steve and Michelle come out after the movie was shown and have like a 5-minute standing ovation. It was just an awe-inspiring feeling, and seeing everybody was up there crying and clapping, and just to see that look on Steve's face of like, oh, my story is touching people in this very visceral way where you're staring at everybody who it has just hit like a ton of bricks, you know? That moment is something I'll never forget, and being up on stage with them. So after our premiere, the distributors start coming around and wanting to try to pick up the film. And, you know, we talked to a lot of people, had a lot of great meetings, but the folks at Amazon at the time, it was Ted Hope and Bob Burney. And Bob Burney, actually, oddly enough, was someone we had worked with. He had bought King of Kong when he was at Picture House. And so we had a prior relationship with him. You sit down with people and you have them explain, sort of give their pitch of like why the movie means something to them and what they want to do with it. And I feel like, you know, that team really got it the most, and they wanted to, like I said, they really wanted to push it, and they were becoming, we were the, I think the first or second doc that sort of new division of Amazon Studios had bought. So they wanted to make us, you know, their flagship project. And we felt honored to do that. And that sort of set us down the path.
Was the film originally financed by the foundation?
It was all private. Really, that was a lot of the work of Seth Gordon, who came on to produce. My wife was also working with him, Mary Rolick. So Seth and Mary helped to get the financing involved through their agency at the time, WME, and had this deal with IMG. So IMG Films funded the project as soon as like me and Seth and Mary all jumped on board. So we got fully financed privately and then took it to the old, like, take it to festivals, try to sell it there. And we were lucky enough to have a little bit of a bidding war and get a good deal for it.
Rivers, Steve and Michelle's son. My question is, has he watched the film? Is he still too young? I have kids that are around that age, but where is Rivers at? Has he seen the film?
To my knowledge, he has not watched the film in its entirety. I have not checked in with Steve and Michelle about that in recent years. I do remember, so the first time I showed Steve and Michelle the film, it really blew them away. And it was something that Michelle, I didn't think, realized like how much of it that she would be in. And so she wanted to show it to everyone immediately. So I remember we watched it with her and Steve, and then she was like, okay, well, my parents have to see this. And so we like went over to her parents' house. I remember Rivers was there, and at the time he was like 4, and he just started to like sit in and watch while we were watching for a little bit. And I was felt so uncomfortable. So I don't know if a four or five year old River should be watching this right now. He's only seen a couple scenes that I'm aware of. But one thing that we did do in the process of categorizing and watching all the footage is Steve had done these video diaries throughout the years. We made a hard drive organized by date, the messages from Steve when he could still talk to Rivers. And so we were able to, you know, side benefit of going through all the footage and organizing it was being able to set that aside so that one day, you know, Rivers could basically have this hard drive of like videos from Steve. And we even, I think, had transcripts made for a bunch of them as well.
It's interesting because the family's grown. They have a daughter, Gray, now that's 2. And I was just curious, like, you know, it feels like if they're still filming, which I'm not sure if you know or not, like it feels like there's an opportunity for something else, not necessarily a film, but it feels like, hey, there could be something else there.
Remember when I told you Michelle said she was done? You ask her that question now, she'll be like, fuck no, get out of here with that camera. You know, there's still like pieces done on the family through ESPN or NFL Network. Like they do check-ins with them, which are great and lovely. And little Gray, who's 2 now, is so cute. I don't think Michelle would have that at all.
I tell you what, I wanted to say the other thing to your comment about Sundance. I feel like that's its own conversation that we can have at another date. But that whole experience in selling a film and going through that, it seemed like you could give a master's class on that.
I've done it a couple times. I've been pretty fortunate. All of my films have, pretty much all of them been bought at a festival and then taken out theatrically. The doc game has changed a little bit in that there's a lot more pre-selling, a lot more distributors and streamers are financing things on the front end rather than waiting till festivals to buy stuff. It's a gamble. It's something that I really enjoy. And I like, through the early part of my career too, just having the creative flexibility of, you know, when it's privately funded, you have more of a sense of being able to control where it goes or even just creative decisions within the film itself.
I think that's a good segue quickly into our act 3, which are just some quick hitters. How do you feel about the state right now of sports documentaries? There seems to be a trend towards athletes controlling their narrative and journalism sort of in real documentary filmmaking going away.
Trying to have people have agency over their own story, I think, is very important. But also, you know, having that perspective, having the filmmaker having some of that autonomy to be able to hold a mirror up to some people in some ways that they might not like all the way, but it is true to who they are. You know, sports documentaries right now, there's great stuff. Everything from, you know, the Malice in the Palace stuff that came on Netflix recently, I really enjoyed. Or, you know, Last Dance was like right up my alley, my prime basketball watching years. I still am of the school of like, I would like to see the filmmakers maintain that autonomy, but have as much of a understanding with the subjects of like being able to still be a sympathetic ear to the subject's interest. I can't give you a like analog one way or another, but it is like complicated.
One of our loyal listeners, my sister, is driving down I-81 right now. And so it made me think of how far you've come from that part of Virginia to where you are now. What is your message to those people that want to be the next Clay?
It's wild for me to think that somebody would want to become a documentary filmmaker. I feel like that's a thing that has only in the last several years been something to like young people would aspire to. I would just preach the message of persistence. It's taken me a lot of persistence to get to where I am, and cold calling people when I first moved here to even today, like having to, if you really want something, being dedicated to going after it and not taking no or not taking a non-answer for an answer.
Last one for me, favorite sports doc of all time.
Really love Leon Gass when they were Kings. And I really love Pumping Iron, which were like two docs that I saw early on in my career that are very different, but great for a lot of different reasons. I love the sort of intimacy, but the music of when they're Kings, you know, being able to find this tone of like a sports doc with a ridiculous character, but you're rooting for the underdog for Pumping Iron. Yeah, I love both of those.
Last one for me, random, but I like asking it. First concert, favorite concert?
First concert I went to by myself was Busta Rhymes.
I was not expecting that one.
My favorite concert might have been the Rakon Tours out here at the Greek Theater. It was just like a kick-ass rock show. And I'm a big Jack White fan, so I love that.
I have to say I've gotten the most goosebumps having this conversation with you, talking about Gleason. I mean, such an incredible film. So I just really want to thank you for your time.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate you taking an interest in my films and me, so appreciate it.
Although tears were not shed, I don't think we've had a more emotional conversation. So a big thanks to Clay for that.
Subscribe, rate, and review the show. And if you do, we'll give you a big shout out. If you like what you heard, please share it with your friends.
We'll be back next week with another great episode of Beyond the Lens, and that's a wrap.